This is The Takeaway for Monday, November 20th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. So glad you're with us today. We're going to take a closer look at the rise and fall of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe this hour and talk to one of the nation's experts on Charles Manson, who died last night at age 83. But we start this Monday Takeaway with two looks inside policing in this country. We're going to continue our series to protect and serve life behind the blue line, where officers talk about their lives in their own words. Today, anonymous testimony from one officer in a complicated relationship with the community he serves. But let's go to Baltimore first, where things are more than just complicated. A federal corruption investigation made its ninth arrest this week. Already, several members of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force have been swept up in a series of busts where prosecutors are charging multiple robberies, drug trafficking, and fraud. Officers on the task force were allegedly stealing drugs and cash and other valuables from residents, sometimes drug dealers, and profiting from those thefts. Now, arrests have spread to Philadelphia, where a cop named Eric Snell has been charged with conspiracy to sell cocaine and heroin taken off the streets by his co-conspirators in Baltimore. Justin Fenton covers the Baltimore Police Department for the Baltimore Sun. Justin, thanks for being here.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Justin, this is a multi-city, now multi-state ring of what prosecutors say are dirty cops. What exactly are they charged with?
So the officers are charged with racketeering. That's the statute that the federal government uses against gangs and the mafia. Basically, this case began when the DEA was doing a drug investigation into a group that had sold some drugs that had led to some fatal overdoses, and ended up picking up a Baltimore police officer on their wiretap. Once they realized this, they referred the case to the FBI, which began monitoring that officer and others in his unit. They ended up using recording devices in the vehicles and ended up charging all seven members of this elite task force with drug dealing, overtime fraud, and robberies.
So there are charges that they would confiscate drugs from busts, turn around and sell them themselves. You talk about robberies. What are the robberies they're charged with?
Basically shaking down citizens, you know, writing a search warrant, going into a home. They would find, you know, a couple $100s in a closet. They'd pocket it, split it up. But some of these robberies were in the thousands of dollars. There was one robbery in a storage unit where they said they got kilograms of cocaine and hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash. So it was pretty lucrative stuff.
Justin, what have the accused officers said here?
Four of the Baltimore officers have pleaded guilty, while four others, including two of the unit's past supervisors, have pleaded not guilty. The trial is tentatively set for January, and I think it's important to note that the bulk of the allegations occurred during a time when the Baltimore Police Department was under investigation by the Justice Department for civil rights violations, so a trial could help provide more insight into how this could have gone on all this time.
So let's review in Baltimore just for a second. We have cops allegedly taking drugs from busts and reselling them for profit, shaking down citizens in traffic stops, taking their money or writing fraudulent warrants to get into their homes, overtime fraud, which sounds like a crime against taxpayers. And now this whole story has spread to Philadelphia.
Correct. There was a Baltimore police officer who was in the police academy with Detective Ray M. He left the force and went to Philadelphia. And one of the allegations that's come out is that even after leaving, he continued to conspire with Detective Ray M. They would seize drugs and then he would sort of send them back up there where that officer gave them to someone who would sell them for profit. And then the money would come back down here.
So we're talking about a cop in Philly named Eric Snell. Is that right?
Correct.
Now, Eric Snell has a fairly narrow charge, it seems, conspiracy to sell cocaine and heroin. Is he part of a broader conspiracy? Are prosecutors saying that?
That's a big question that we had. I mean, the Philadelphia Police Department was pretty tight-lipped when this came down. I mean, it sort of raises the question of what's going on. You know, the officers here were considered to be a very elite gun task force. They had a great amount of autonomy. They could go throughout the entire city chasing guns and drugs. The department held them up as one of the best units they had. I think just a few months before the indictments came down, there was a department newsletter where there was a picture of the unit, and they were touting their work. Of course, you know, they were also responsible for dozens and dozens of arrests, and now it's coming out that, you know, just for years, they were pretty much doing whatever they wanted to do.
And Justin, look, there's a long history of alleged misconduct in Baltimore, and of course, the high-profile trials of officers in the case of Freddie Gray and his death while in police custody. This new round of charges can't do anything to help the reputation in Baltimore.
I mean, I think it's definitely a difficult thing for the police department in terms of the idea that, you know, the misconduct is committed by a few bad apples. I mean, this is an entire unit. This was supposed to be the best of the best, and it's really had major shockwaves already. I think that they disbanded their plainclothes units. Gun seizures by police are down 30% since that happened, and, you know, we're about to go under federal consent decree monitoring. So this is all sort of happening all at the same time as the city is also dealing with surging crime rates on the streets. So, I mean, it's definitely not a good time for the Baltimore Police Department.
Justin Fenton, who covers the Baltimore Police Department for the Baltimore Sun. Hey, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We have another installment now in our series, Life Behind the Blue Line, where cops talk about their lives and their jobs in their own words. Some police officers have spoken with us on the record, but many more were either barred from talking to the media by their departments or just skeptical themselves that a news program would represent them fairly. Today, we talked to one officer who insisted on remaining anonymous. Now, just to be clear, this cop has no connection to the Baltimore Police Department or the story that you just heard a minute ago.
I work as a police officer for a urban Midwestern department. Well, I've been a police officer for between 3 to 5 years, we'll put it that way. And I'm just a regular patrol officer, so I answer 911 calls. I, you know, try and provide, you know, proactive police service when it's appropriate, and just kind of handle what pops up day to day. I do work the night shift. I don't give the precise hours, but think, you know, in the range of between 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. At least where I work, the kind of work that we do is actually very seasonal. Every summer, like clockwork, we have a whole bunch of robbery that we have to deal with, where you might come in and just immediately out of roll call, you're answering 911 calls, and you just, you go call to call all night, and you don't really have time to kind of sit back and breathe. Our gang violence ticks up, so we get more shootings, especially during the summer, and especially the really hot nights when it's, you know, 85 degrees at night, and for some reason that just makes the violence go nuts. On a busy Saturday night, I alone might take 3 robbery reports, you know, and at least one of those is probably going to involve a gun or a knife or significant injuries, you know, somebody knocked out with a brick or something like that. And then by the end of the winter, you actually kind of get bored with, you know, you'll have several nights in a row where you maybe have 3 or 4 calls you answer, and you're kind of hunting for stuff to do. It is actually kind of nice that we get as much of a slowdown in the winter as we do, because it kind of gives you time to recoup from the summer and fall. The job is a weird mix of, especially in 911 response, it's a weird mix of sedentary, because you're sitting in your police car all the time, and then sudden sprinting or like fighting for your life with somebody. And, you know, when you're working nights, it's not like the places that serve healthy food are open. You know, it's like pizza shops and maybe some Euro shops or something. Although I'm working on reversing this trend, I'm not as healthy as I was 10 years ago. When I get home from a shift at work, even on nights where it's not absolutely crazy, and you get home on time instead of having to finish up reports and overtime, you get home, and because of the nature of the work, you're always at least a little bit alert or on edge. Multiple times I've had a gunfight start within 30 to 40 feet of me. You just never have that time to relax, and you generate fatigue, and it seems to be cumulative. And this is true of everybody I've talked to in the job, and everybody agrees that when you work 5, 6, 7 days in a row, by the end of that 6th or 7th day, there's like a level of fatigue that sits in that just doesn't go away until you get 2, 3 days off, and you can kind of relax and not, you know, try and watch the hands of everybody that goes by, try and think, you know, oh, is that guy going to, you know, is he following that other person because he's planning on a robbery? Or just having that chance to just not intently watch everybody that comes within a block of you is really important for being able to actually just reset your brain. The stress inherent in police work, or for that matter, being a paramedic, being a firefighter, there's an unavoidable level of stress. I mean, there's just no way to get around that that's going to happen. You know, the rate of suicide amongst police officers is some number of times the national average, stuff like that. And so just like the military, police departments and paramedic agencies and firefighting departments are starting to understand that they do have to put in place programs to help deal with that. But there's just no way to eliminate it. I believe that somebody has to do this work. You just come into contact with dangerous or violent people, or even just people that are regular folks, and they're on the worst, or amongst, you know, the handful of the worst days in their life, or things are out of control in whatever their situation is. You know, call after call, you show up, and then you try and calm everything down, split people apart, you know, try and figure out what's going on, figure out if a crime occurred, at the very least, keep any further injuries from occurring, or, you know, if there are injuries that have already happened, handle those, you know, whatever you got to do. No department in this country, I don't think, has the time or the money to give everybody all the training that they should get in an ideal world. And so it's kind of on you to maintain your own, you know, I don't know, skills with a firearm, all that kind of stuff, because all those are perishable skills. They all go away. And like I said, I mean, our job is to be out there answering 911 calls. So we can't spend, you know, 2 days a week training, which in an ideal world, that's what we would be doing. But that's never going to happen. You know, one of my stories from this past summer was I went from one call where a 17-year-old girl, who I believe was a runaway, she had been sexually assaulted by a group of people. She had bruises on her neck, her limbs, all that kind of stuff. She was, you know, incoherent with trauma. You know, I rode to the hospital with her in the ambulance. And then from there, I went to a woman who had called 911 because she was upset at the customer service at the hotel she was staying at. And so you just have to develop that skill where whatever the previous call is, now you're done with it. Now you handle the new thing. So yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I do think that police are seen, you know, not by everybody, but by a lot of people, and especially in the area where I live and work, extremely negatively right now. We're viewed with a lot of suspicion. I honestly don't think the public has any idea what's involved in police work and the kind of work that we do. You know, the average person will maybe once or twice in their life, they'll leave their bag visible in their car and somebody breaks out the window and takes their bag. Or, you know, worse, they might be robbed or something. Whereas for me, that's one of between 10 and 20 such incidents on any given weekend. They have no idea. You know, in my precinct, we have a significant problem with robbery. And so if, for example, there's a robbery that occurs on one street corner and we have video or a good witness description of the suspect, and then, you know, a half hour later, we find one or more of those suspects, everybody watching doesn't have any idea. All they see is, here's these three guys that were just standing on the sidewalk. And then suddenly a whole bunch of cops showed up. And as far as they can tell, those three guys haven't violated any laws. And so, you know, why are the police doing that? People, I think, have a tendency to just, they see something that happens and they don't step back and think, man, the cops are being really serious about whoever these folks are, this guy is that they're trying to take into custody. I wonder if there's a reason for that. You know, I think about all of these kind of issues more than is probably healthy. I would like people to expand the research that they're doing. And this is a huge problem in my city right now. Researchers are tasked to come in and look at the police department, which is fine. But then the only thing that they look at is the police department. And so, you know, if we're going to talk about racially disproportionate arrests in my city, I would like to see research that addresses the racial proportions of suspect descriptions in our 911 calls and police reports we receive from victims. I would like to see that research compared with the racial makeup of our victims more broadly, because I can tell you that I don't have the exact numbers on me right now, but somewhere between like 85 and 95% of our murder and shooting victims are African American. So when we're talking about, you know, disproportionate impacts of police action and stuff like that, well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's disproportionate in our society right now. The poverty rate in the African American community in my city is higher than, you know, most of the other communities in the city, and a lot of the effects of the economic recovery have not showed up in the areas of my city that are, you know, historically African American. You know, crime tends to be higher in those neighborhoods, and so, you know, both our suspects and our victims are not proportionate to the racial distribution of the city. I would really like for research to start looking at, you know, if these are the actions the police are taking, to what extent is that driven by response to, you know, the 911 calls and stuff that we're receiving? Here's another thing that I think people don't understand about policing is that, so when we have, for example, a significant robbery problem in my precinct, we are going to stop the wrong guy sometimes. All we have to go on is, like, sometimes, you know, at best, like, maybe grainy video or a description given to us by a witness, because victim descriptions are typically useless. We are going to stop the wrong guy sometimes. That's going to happen. And then we have some time to investigate. And we're like, oh, it looks like this was the wrong guy. Then we take the handcuffs off and send them on their way. And I'll say to him, you know, yeah, I understand getting stopped by the police, especially, you know, if we're stopping you at gunpoint because it's related to like a gunpoint robbery or something. That's awful. Like, four or five cops hop out in uniform. We've got guns pointed at you. We tell you to lie down on the ground. The ground is gross or uncomfortable or wet, whatever it is. We put handcuffs on you. We might, you know, kneel on you to limit your mobility. That's awful. And I get it, but I just, if we want to do things like take a violent robber off the street, then that is a cost that we're going to have to be willing to pay as a society collectively. And we need to just have people understand that if the police hop out on you and we're giving you some commands, that as long as you just comply with those, whatever they are, even though you yourself know for a fact that you didn't do anything, we don't know that. If we're going to be able to stop the right guy, then we have to be able to run the risk of stopping the wrong guy. The thing that I think creates a problem for media portrayals of police is that we're really not able to provide our side of the story or our evidence. That's why you get a lot of these very samey statements from, you know, an agency's public information officer or something that says, we're aware of this allegation and an internal and external review are being conducted, something like that. I do think that we're going to have to, across the country, start looking at, for example, the way Las Vegas Metro PD, every time they have an officer-involved shooting, I think within 72 hours, they have a media briefing. They provide some of the context, you know, some of the call record, weapons recovered at the scene. They post some of the body cam video. And I think more agencies are going to have to start doing that. You know, I don't know exactly what the answer is. Agencies across this country have to do a better job of communicating. We're creating a really long-term, maybe trust deficit by our kind of collective refusal to communicate more clearly.
If you're a cop who'd like to participate, give us a call. 8778-MY-TAKE. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. One of the most infamous murderers of the last century has died. Charles Manson died yesterday while serving a life sentence in prison in California. He was 83. Manson and his followers, mostly young women known as his family, were convicted of the brutal Tate-LaBianca murders committed over two nights in August of 1969. The gruesome, horrific nature of these killings and the ensuing 9.5-month trial gripped the country and spawned an obsession with Manson. Jeff Gwynn is the author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. He takes us back to August 1969 in Los Angeles.
Society was all torn apart. The Vietnam War, there were race riots. There was a cultural war going on. Conservatives looking at these long-haired hippie freaks and saying they're going to be the ruination of America. In a lot of ways, it was much like today. Manson became a popular story because no matter who you were, no matter what background you were from, you projected on him what you wanted him to be. A lot of people saw him exactly as he was, which is a cold-blooded sociopath who was going to do anything to anyone and not feel a bit guilty. But there were a lot of people who saw him as a cool rebel against the controlling evil governmental forces. There were people who tried to present him as a poor kid who had a terrible childhood, never had a chance to grow up right. He literally became America's entertainment in a very gruesome, grisly way. We could sort of call him the criminal Kardashian.
Jeff, can you take us back to California in August of 1969 and remind us what happened with the Tate-LaBianca murders and what Manson and his cohorts did?
The Tate-LaBianca murders were set up to make it appear as though an earlier murder by a member of the Manson family had been committed by the Black Panthers or any real militant black group. They didn't care which, as long as the blacks got the blame. Sharon Tate was the wife of Roman Polanski. She was a modestly famous actress, but Polanski was famous at the time. The murders occurred in some of the toniest neighborhoods in Los Angeles. The fact that in a city where supposedly famous people were beyond any danger panicked the rest of the city, and it escalated because it took so long to catch Manson and his followers. And once they were caught, they were so bizarre, the story just got extra legs and kept going and going.
And there wound up being connections even to the President of the United States.
Very much so. Richard Nixon, who was then president, at one point during Manson's trial, publicly said Manson was guilty. That could have been grounds for a mistrial, and Charlie Manson could have been back walking the streets. And I promise you, if at any time between the day of his death yesterday and the day of his original arrest for Tate-LaBianca, if Manson had been set free, he just would have found people to do things that were even worse.
And during his many years in prison from 1969 till just yesterday, did Charles Manson ever express any remorse or anything other than pleasure for his crimes or for his grim position in American culture?
No, he very much enjoyed his platform as a celebrity. And frankly, if somehow he's looking back from whatever special section of hell he would be in this morning, he would be excited that there's still so much attention being paid to him. He has planted himself indelibly into our national culture, and it says a lot about his ability to manipulate that he did that.
Charles Manson, dead at 83. Jeff Gwynn is author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff Gwynn, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. There was confusion in Zimbabwe on Sunday. Even more confusion than the coup that country's been going through has already produced. Longtime ruler Robert Mugabe was supposed to resign and give up power in a televised address, but give up power he did not. Instead, Mugabe said he's staying on the scene.
The Congress is due in a few weeks from now. I will preside over its processes, which must not be prepossessed by any acts calculated to undermine it.
Robert Mugabe, 93 years old, saying he will preside over the Congress in Zimbabwe in a couple of weeks. Robert Mugabe could now wind up getting impeached by his own party in a new twist in the strange transition of power that's been unfolding in Zimbabwe for the past week. Peter Godwin joins me now. He's a former human rights lawyer in Zimbabwe who was born and raised there. He's also author of The Fear, Robert Mugabe and the Martyrdom of Zimbabwe. Peter, good to have you.
Hi.
Peter, there appears, as I said, to be a great deal of confusion over what happened on Sunday and that sound of Robert Mugabe we just played. What are you hearing?
Confusion doesn't even start to cover it. I mean, it's been a farce, really. It's been absolutely extraordinary. The whole of Zimbabwe was expecting and had been told to expect Robert Mugabe's resignation last night. He was taken to the studio. This whole thing was all set up. And he sat there with army officers on one side and some of his own people on the other side and gave this rambling, almost incoherent speech, which didn't mention resignation at all. And so Zimbabweans this morning are just trying to figure out what actually happened. There are all sorts of bizarre theories, including a kind of switcheroo theory. At one point, one of the generals appears to take a page off the desk, and people are saying, well, was that the page where Mugabe was supposed to resign? So it was a really bizarre situation.
What are you hearing from behind the scenes, Peter? Is this just a matter of a trip inside the mind of Robert Mugabe, who's ruled this country since 1980 and isn't going anywhere? Or is there a broader coalition trying to keep him in power?
Yeah, a trip inside Mugabe's mind at the moment would be an extraordinary thing. He looks as though he's becoming slightly senile. I mean, when he gave that speech, it was rambling and slightly incoherent. I think that this is his last-ditch attempt to somehow survive, but he's becoming increasingly detached from reality. It was really his last chance to leave with any crumb of dignity. It was his sort of soft landing opportunity, and he's walked away from that. So now, today, the ruling party, his ruling party, ZANU-PF, is meeting, and the plan is, I think, that tomorrow they will start impeachment proceedings in Zimbabwe's parliament.
So even Mugabe's own party, after all of these years of rule, is ready to cut him loose.
Well, it absolutely, because what you're seeing here, and it's just as well, you know, to remind oneself that this isn't a kind of people's revolution that's playing out. We had these wonderful jubilant scenes in Harare, in particular in Zimbabwe on Saturday, where there were enormous crowds marching, etc. But really what we're seeing in high politics is musical chairs among the leadership of the ruling party, ZANU-PF, which is the only party that's ever ruled Zimbabwe for nearly 40 years. So, yes, what we're seeing is a kind of, you know, Mugabe's wife made a play, a premature play, as it turned out, for the leadership herself. She saw herself as some kind of Evita Perón or Imelda Marcos or Madame Mao, and it didn't work. She didn't have the support of the army. And so her main rival, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who had recently been fired as vice president by Mugabe, is the putative heir to the throne.
Peter, musical chairs at the top in high politics, as you mentioned, but Zimbabwe is a country with extraordinarily high unemployment, a struggling economy, very high illiteracy. Are there any opportunities in a change of power here in a post-Mugabe Zimbabwe? Are any of these players that you're talking about going to bring a little bit of relief to the struggling nation?
Yes, I think there's always opportunity when you see a change in regime or change in leadership of a regime that's been in power for this long. What you saw on Saturday in the streets of Zimbabwe was this absolute sort of desperation among Zimbabweans for change, any glimmer of hope. You've had this cold sort of dead hand of stasis on them for so long. They're just desperate for some sort of change. And it's quite possible that Emmerson Mnangagwa, who will probably replace Mugabe, may lose control of this situation, that once people you know, once people see a new person there and it's not Robert Mugabe, because in the last sort of decades, Mugabe had hollowed out ZANU-PF and created a kind of personality cult. It had become a very personal thing. And if he's suddenly gone, there may be a bit of a vacuum there. Emmerson Mnangagwa isn't wrapped in quite the same mythology. He's not quite as charismatic. And so absolutely, there is a possibility that this may be the beginning of some kind of real change in Zimbabwe.
I mean, this is a country where the vast majority of citizens have never known a Zimbabwe with anything but Robert Mugabe at the top. This was a military coup, Peter, that was billed not as a military coup, bloodless though it were. Do people on the streets have confidence that after a month or two or a couple of weeks that the generals will step aside, that they will have elections in their country?
Yeah, this isn't sort of your grandfather's coup. This is kind of coup 2.0, coup light, in the sense that what it is it's the general that you see there, and indeed the person who went on TV, at 4 o'clock in the morning and in uniform and read a statement. They are not looking to be in power themselves. They are looking to put Emmerson Mnangagwa in power. So in that sense, it's not the sort of classic West African Nigerian coup. That's not what you're seeing. And they've been very careful to try and keep it within constitutional confines so that they don't run afoul of the regional organizations like the African Unity or big neighbors like South Africa who don't want to see an actual coup because it's kind of bad for business. So I think Zimbabweans are confident that this will remain a kind of pseudo-civilian regime. But then bear in mind that Mugabe has been backed by the army and the police and the oppression for many, many years, and violence is just beneath the surface in their rule.
Some potential for real change during a shift of power in Zimbabwe if they can manage to get Robert Mugabe off the scene by the end of the week. Peter Goodwin, author of The Fear, Robert Mugabe and the Martyrdom of Zimbabwe. Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks.
It's the 107th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution today. Back in 1910, a broad swath of Mexico revolted against the government of Porfirio Diaz, and a big part of that war were Mexican peasants, farmers, demanding their right to land. Today, many small-scale Mexican farmers feel like their struggle isn't over. They say the North American Free Trade Agreement has taken away their ability to make a living growing corn. And as NAFTA negotiations enter their fifth round, many of those small farmers say they want out. Frank Contreras is a correspondent with China Global Television Network America in Mexico City. Frank, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Glad to be with you.
Frank, if you followed the presidential campaign in 2016 here in the United States, you got the message that NAFTA was a terrible deal for America and that Mexico was getting away with a lot under that deal. But small farmers in Mexico wouldn't agree with that.
No, if you look at the statistics that come actually from the Mexican government themselves, there are some 6 million small-scale farmers in Mexico who basically needed to abandon their fields under all the years that NAFTA has been in place, Todd. And we're talking about more than 20 years now. And so many of those farmers had to move to the cities, places like where I'm speaking to you from, Mexico City. A huge change, right, from the cultural reality, the small-scale farms in rural indigenous lands, moving themselves into major cities, trying to seek jobs, and so having a real tough time of it. And they largely blame the North American Free Trade Agreement.
What happened? I mean, let's get economic here. What happened to corn in Mexico?
Well, in general, Mexico was the creator of corn. It's the birthplace and known as the origin of the corn seed. Under NAFTA, Mexico has actually become a net importer of U.S. corn. And that's largely the kind of corn that's being used to make industrial produced processed foods, the kind of foods that are more and more available now under the North American Free Trade Agreement. And of course, those products come from industrial scale farms in the United States.
Why is American industrial corn so cheap?
The Mexican government argues that the corn coming from the United States is so cheap because it's subsidized by the United States government.
Frank, you know, other agricultural sectors in Mexico have done very well. I think I read that avocados do very well in Mexico. Free trade deals are supposed to be about the trade-offs, right? That's what they always say. The United States has lost some manufacturing. Some agriculture is doing very well. Is that different in Mexico?
In general, in Mexico, what we see is, you pointed out the avocado industry. That industry has boomed largely because Mexican avocado producers have been able to compete directly with their main competitors, which are producers in California. And so what they're able to do is export a huge number, hundreds of tons per day from certain parts of a small city called Uruapan in Michoacan state. That's a state that used to send many thousands of migrants to the United States, but now it actually has a thriving internal economy, Todd. That's because they're able to produce and export so many avocados to the United States when California farmers, you know, are not able to produce year-round. That's one of the edges that the Mexican producers get from that sector. But from other parts of the economy, for example, it's not just corn that's been harmed. We're also told here from Mexican government statistics that rice producers, there are actually a good number of rice producers in the areas around Mexico City. In the state just south of Mexico City, which is known as Morelos State, that's where the Mexican Revolution started in the fields. It was led by General Emiliano Zapata. You've heard his name, the guy with the big mustache who rode the horse and led peasant farmers to the revolt. As you pointed out in the intro here, the decree there was, you know, land and liberty. They were going to give their lives to be able to fight for the land, to fight for the right to work the land. So in those states here, a lot of farmers have lost their ability to produce competitively with the mass scale farmers in places like the United States and around the world. Mostly, though, I would say it's the United States. And again, they point to the North American Free Trade Agreement.
And these small scale farmers, there are millions of them, as you say. What's their voice here, Frank? Are they able to be heard by negotiators? Are they being heard by their government?
Most of the time, they're not being heard, Todd. But lately, because you start to hear a lot of criticism of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, coming from Washington and the current administration there, the Trump administration, oddly enough, these political strange bedfellows are somehow opening up doorways, political doorways, so that you can start to hear more the perspectives of these small-scale farmers. By the way, the Mexican government itself says that the number of overall farmers in the country under NAFTA in these years that that trade agreement has been in place, that number has grown, according to the Mexican government, by 1.7 million. There are 1.7 million more Mexican farmers now in the land, but it's still unable to compete with the United States.
Well, Frank, we can talk about the economic losses for small farmers in free trade agreements like this one, but what about the cultural ones? What does the loss of a corn industry or a corn culture mean to people in Mexico?
In Mexico, it means everything. Remember, there were ancient civilizations in place in Mexico before the conquest of Spain here in this part of the world, known as the New World back then. And what brought those civilizations to life was corn. For Mexicans, corn is like what rice is to the Japanese or to any Asian culture. It's the basis of their food supply. It's the kind of food they use in celebrations. So it's an intrinsic part of how people eat, but also how they come to think of themselves and their world and the history of their cultures here in this part of the world. So when that starts to get taken away or weakened, then it begins to weaken what anthropologists call the fabric of Mexican civilization here.
Frank Contreras with China Global Television Network America in Mexico City. Frank, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to do it. Thanks, Todd.
Thanks for being with us today here on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey caught the nation's attention earlier this month, but local and state races yielded other notable results too. 8 openly transgender politicians won races from school board in New Hampshire to state assembly in Virginia. In Minnesota, Andrea Jenkins became the first openly transgender woman of color elected to public office in the United States when she was elected to city council in Minneapolis.
It feels incredible. I think it's a symbol of hope for not only transgender people, but all people.
Those are big wins for transgender people, and they suggest that attitudes are changing in this country. But for Lala Zanel, those victories are only part of the story. According to the Human Rights Campaign, at least 25 transgender Americans have been murdered in America in 2017, the most on record. Today marks the Transgender Day of Remembrance. Lala Zanel is lead organizer at the New York City Anti-Violence Project, and she's here to talk about this Day of Remembrance in victorious but still violent times for transgender people. Lala, thanks for being here.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is the Transgender Day of Remembrance. What are you thinking about today?
Well, days like this are always very hard. They're very emotional, but also very empowering. And so I've been gearing up for today or this weekend and had my moment of sadness because I lost a lot of friends this past year that I personally knew or knew through other community members and holding them down during that time. And so today is important to me to lift up the folks we lost, but also to look around at each other and like uplift TGNC folks, particularly trans women of color that are alive today.
Lala, you used the acronym TGNC. What does that mean?
Transgender Nonconforming.
And so you said that you have several friends this year that you've lost. Did you lose them to violence?
Throughout my life, I've lost so many friends throughout my life. I'm from Detroit, Michigan originally. And I've had so many friends of mine just being killed for simply who they are. And back then, and still sometimes today, like there's no recourse. There was no discussion. It was just they were killed and kept moving on. And so it wasn't until I moved to New York City and Elon Nettles had passed where I actually was in a space where I actually to see trans women of color actually mourning deaths of trans women. And it was so empowering and healing to actually be able to mourn someone that we lost in a time where I grew up, where I was told there was not no room for mourning. Be glad that you're still here. And that was the motive. It was no time for grief because they knew that police didn't care, families didn't care half the time. A lot of my friends got buried under their dead names. A lot of my friends, we weren't even allowed to say goodbye. And so it's always funny to me that chosen family gets so erased when so many trans folks, particularly trans women of color, are being raised by chosen communities, or we're the chosen communities, we're parents in these communities. And when we leave, the parents that never affirmed them, never cared about them, threw them out to the streets, would like to come and claim the body and bury them, not in their authentic self. And so like that really hurt me to see as well.
Lala, you suggested that things have changed to some degree, that now you can mourn your friends in public. Now you don't have to bury them under their dead names, that now they're not just pushed to the side or those deaths aren't in the shadows. And that sounds comforting, and yet these deaths are still going on. I just quoted a figure of 25 murders so far this year, and 2017 isn't over. I mean, I would love to celebrate with you, but the violence is still going on.
Yes, the violence is going on, and it's going to continue to go on due to the misgendering that happens. So we know that there are probably more deaths because of the misgendering that happens to trans folks. We also know that there's nothing going on in this country really to address the root causes of violence that happens to trans folks, particularly trans women of color. There's no conversation around how misogyny and toxic masculinity plays a big part, particularly in people of color communities where they're policed on their masculinity and policed and taught through religion and through systems that trans folks are disposable, that we're an abomination, that we should go to hell, and that it's okay to beat us. And the crime, the legislation in this country proves that it's okay. And in this current political climate, where we have a president that has clearly has an agenda against LGBT folks and no space for trans folks, particularly trans folks and undocumented folks of color, it's important that we as community leaders and we as politicians and we as people in power that may not be on that level, to every day you get up, your day is to dismantle transphobia in your life. Every day you get up is for you to be a bigger person and carve out space for trans folks of color and trans folks in your life, period. And that's how you create change. And so, yes, today is sad. And yes, we have lost over 25 trans women, and particularly a lot of them being trans women of color. But guess what? We are still here living unapologetically in our truth, you know? And so, like, today, it's hard. But I have to look at the people that are still here breathing, and every day that I get up and I'm still here, that's a blessing, because the reality is I can leave this interview today and be attacked outside simply for who I am. I could be killed on the streets right outside this very studio I'm sitting in. That's the reality of this country. And people need to learn that reality and humanize trans folks, and not just say the names and not just come around for T-Door because you think that's important, but show up 365 days out of the year. Trans folks are 100% commitment like every other community.
Well, Lala, let's talk about how things are today. On the one hand, there's this violence. On the other hand, it's clear that societal attitudes are changing when it comes to transgender folks, right? I mean, we talked about 8 politicians elected just 2 Tuesdays ago. That's real power that transgender people are getting for themselves, something that would have been unheard of 5 or 10 years ago. So there are these two things going on at the same time, right? Changing societal attitudes, and yet in the basic safety for transgender folks, things aren't changing.
Yes, some trans folks have won, and that's brilliant. But I don't want the narrative to be because they were trans. They won because they were politically brilliant. They're smart. They're innovative. And they know what their communities need. And they took that chance to be their full authentic self, to put themselves on the line for change, not just for trans and gender nonconforming folks, but for the communities that they lived in. And so for me, I'm very happy. Andrea Jenkins is like a chosen community sister to me. And I just saw her in Philly last year, and she was telling me she was going for city council. And I was like, I got you. You know, like, I support you. And so to hear someone that I personally know win, like, that's history. And like, I believe that there are so many new trans and gender nonconforming ancestors and historians that will be in this next generation. So moving forward, if it doesn't even happen, the violence doesn't end in my lifetime, at least I know there's a lot of work being down on the ground, that when I leave and when Andrea Jenkins leave and all these other leaders leave, there will be a template of history there for trans folks who are, when I came out, I didn't see visible trans folks. I didn't see any possibility models of anything else besides violence. And so that narrative is changing. And so I think that's also important. And we also must go deeper. Like, yes, they won, but we need to go deeper and be able to win wins in bigger states with more power, political power as well. And so we have to prepare transgender nonconforming folks and get them into politics and show this country that we are a powerful constituency, and we do have thoughts, and we do know how to shift things that are going on in this country. And we're not just a conversation that you can have about us, but us not sitting at the table. And so that we're taking control of our narratives, and we're putting ourselves in those spaces, even though they're uncomfortable, even though that we know that they're hard, but we're showing up more than ever. And we have no choice but to, because of this new political regime that's constantly always attacking trans folks and shifting the narrative that we're just like these horrible people. And we're just trying to combat that.
Celebrations and a reckoning with the realities of violence against transgender people still in America in 2017. Lala Zinnell, thank you for being with us today on this Transgender Day of Remembrance. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to you for being with us on this Monday. That's all for us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time. By Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org. And ACLU, which works nationwide to protect the constitutional rights of all people. ACLU.org. ACLU, we the people.